Well, good evening. I'd like to first of all thank you all for the opportunity to let us come up here and share with you. We never get tired of sharing about the ministry that God has laid on our hearts and our heart for the ministry and sharing it with other people and what God's doing there. So we want to thank you for that. From the earliest days that I can remember, back to 5, 6 years old, my father was heavily involved in inner city ministry, and he believed he had a strong vision for the ministry of God and also a strong vision for his family. And while he would go into the city, while he would go into the inner cities and ministering and doing his work, he would bring us with him. And from a young age of 5 or 6 years old, I remember going with my father into the city of Waterbury, Connecticut, which is where I'm from, and going into the slums and the houses, and just from that, every Saturday, getting a vision for the city. So in my life, I've been involved in, or gone in with my father and others into the city from early as the age of 5 or 6 years old. I've been involved in the city of Lancaster, I think for about 15 years now, and been part of a route for about 12 of that. So I'm really excited that you give us the opportunity that we can come up here and share what God's doing and pass the vision along. Tonight, we want to talk about culture. First of all, do we believe that even though we live in the same country and only a half hour's drive or so from our place of ministry, that we could be ministering to a totally different culture? Do we believe that? Definitely. Most definitely. Do we believe that we can have different cultures in a room this size? Even though we go to the same church, worship the same God, many different cultures in a room like this. And I just want to clarify before we go any further, this topic of culture that we want to try to tackle tonight in the next so many minutes is a huge topic that could take a whole week-long session and still maybe not get the full grasp of it. So I'm not planning on giving a exhaustive study on it, but rather just an overview. We want to talk about culture in general. Then we want to talk about their culture as far as inner city life. And then we want to talk about biblical culture and the difference between those three. So first of all, what is culture? When we say that, what comes to your mind? Anybody? What comes to your mind when we say culture? Lifestyle? Good. Different ways of living? Traditions? Good. Good, that all sums it up pretty well. I don't know that I can actually put a real good grasp on what exactly culture is without deep study and whatever, looking into it. But in a nutshell, we're going to use tonight as a definition is culture is a way of life for an entire society. Or maybe perspective. It's a perspective that a people have on life. And a culture is an interesting thing. It many people have tried to explain it many different ways. I've heard it said once that culture is like a roadmap. It's what we look to for direction in our life. Every aspect of everything that we do is based on the culture that we live in and we grow up in. And to recognize that and to also recognize the ministry that we are reaching to is of a different culture, and getting a grasp of understanding of where they're coming from is crucial in bringing them the gospel. A couple stories. I grew up in Connecticut, the state of Connecticut, on the East Coast. When I was born, my parents were Catholic, and they got saved. I was at the age of 2. I actually got baptized into the Catholic Church. At the age of 2, they got saved and moved our family to a Baptist church where we were for the next 11 years. We were there for 9 years. At the age of 11, then we moved to Pennsylvania. My family was seeking more than what could be offered, than what they saw around them in where they were going to church at that time. And we moved to Pennsylvania, and even though I was only 11 years old at that time, moving to Pennsylvania into a plain community, I had never known anything of that in Connecticut. I had never been raised amongst Mennonites or Amish, any plain setting. I actually didn't even know they existed, to be honest with you. And even though I was only 11 years old, and 11-year-olds are fairly able to adapt fairly well to their surroundings, there were many things that still caught me by surprise many different times. And it just gives you a glimpse of different cultures that we're raised in and how we can view or see things. We were moved in Pennsylvania, and we were only here a short amount of time, and we invited our Mennonite neighbors over. These would have been old order Mennonites, horse and buggy, to come over our house, and they were at our house on a Sunday afternoon for a meal. And we were sitting around the living room, and there was a picture of a farm on the wall. And completely ignorant to any of the plain background or any of their culture or anything. And we were sitting there, and one of the boys pointed at the picture, and he said, "What for picture is that?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "What for picture is that?" And I had no idea what he was talking about. I had never heard the phrase "for" in a sentence before. I had no idea what he was talking about. And so I sat there, and I'm thinking, okay, Jared, think this through. You can figure it out. What for picture is that? What picture is that? It wasn't coming. I couldn't figure it out. So I finally said, I'm going to have to shoot in the dark here. I just said, it's a picture of a farm. And that seemed to satisfy him. And it was a couple of months before I actually realized what he was trying to say. And, of course, now I know he was asking, what kind of picture is that? But I had never heard that term before. Just a little glimpse of someone coming from the outside, I guess. Another quick story of culture. That was a different culture. We were in another family's house, and they had also come from a plain setting. I'm not just... That's where I was at. So that's some of the culture differences that I was facing in moving to Pennsylvania. And we were in their house with them, and they were curious about our background. So my sister, the one lady, asked my sister, she said, where are you from? No, she asked, where are you from? And we said we're from Connecticut. And she asked, what is your background? And our background being mostly English from Great Britain, and then also has some Italian and Polish in it. She said to her that we were English. And she said, "Well, I know, but what background are you?" "Well, we're English." "Well, I know you're English." And the other family, there was another family who was also there who knew exactly what was going on, but he was enjoying it way too much to interrupt. So he was just smiling and watching, and again she asked, "Yeah, I know you're English, but what background are you?" And we're English. I don't know what else to say. So finally he jumped in and said, when they mean English, they mean outsider or not from a plain background. But in actuality, she means our ancestors came from Great Britain or England. So there was just a miscommunication there, and it's interesting how cultural... there's a different aspect. We totally misunderstood what each other was asking or saying. Culture. When we grew up, like I said, my background is mostly as English and an Italian and also some Polish in it. And so we grew up with a lot of Italian foods, a lot of Polish foods. We grew up with manicotti, tortellini. We grew up with halushki and those are the foods that we had. I had never heard of a casserole until we moved to Pennsylvania. And no offense, I actually have come to learn to enjoy them very much, but I had never even heard of one. And at first when I saw people taking our leftover Thanksgiving meal and putting stuffing and turkey and gravy together, I couldn't figure out what she was doing, but it ended up being very good the next day. Another example of culture. I had the opportunity about, 6 years ago maybe, to go to Africa on a missions team. And while we were in Africa, and I had many cultural opportunities and experiences there, but when we were in Africa, we were walking the streets, we would sing in schools, we had a team of about, I think, 10 youth, and we would preach in schools, we would sing, and got into many government schools where we had opportunity to witness and to share the gospel with the children. But we also had opportunities to walk the streets, and we were walking the streets one time, and just sharing and witnessing, and a guy came up to me about my age, maybe a little bit younger, and he just looked at me, and he had this big smile on his face, and he held out his hand and grabbed my hand, and held my hand. And I was a little shocked at first, and we were walking down the street, and he just kept walking, holding my hand. He looked at me, he had this big smile on his face, and I looked back and a little confused. Is that socially acceptable here? For two guys to walk hand in hand down the street? No, absolutely not. Big misunderstanding if someone would do that. But there, doing that, holding your hands, walking down the street, simply means we're best friends. Or we're good friends. It's like a handshake would be here, or a pat on the back. There, you hold hands. Different cultures. One more example. And when we were on that same team to Africa, my wife was actually on the team also. She had as a Hutterite background, grew up in South Dakota and Manitoba, Canada. And I came, obviously, I told you already, from Connecticut. But we ended up meeting on that same team, came home, and got married about a year later. And we had a lot of cultural differences coming from two opposite ends of the country. Me coming from English background, or the world, and her coming from the Hutterite background, having more traditions. And putting those two together, blending them together in a marriage, can it work? Can God use that? He can. And the interesting thing is, even though we had many different things to work out and many different understandings, we found now, as we've grown together for the last 4 or 5 years, that we are forming another culture together that is more united and is more in both of ours, where we have left the cultures that we were from and are now together forming another culture together. And that's a beautiful thing. And I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but I'm just going to make this point. When we're ministering to another culture, and we bring them, there's aspects of that culture that are wrong or right. When we bring them into Christ, they are entering into a new culture. Do they leave everything of their old culture behind them? No, absolutely not. That's part of their life. But they're entering into a new culture. And as they grow in grace and in Christ, they eventually too will start forming into that new culture, growing ever closer to Jesus Christ. And that is a beautiful thing. That is what we want for each one of them. Culture. It's a term used for a people's whole way of life. A people's culture consists of all the ideas, objects, and ways of doing things created by the group. Culture includes arts, beliefs, customs, inventions, language, technology, and traditions. The term civilization is similar, but it refers mostly to scientifically more advanced ways of life. A culture is any way of life, simple or complex, a way of life for an entire society. Culture affects everything we do. I don't know, even as Christians, that we've come in Christ and we are in this new culture that is God-centered and Christ-centered, a biblical culture per se. And as we're ever growing closer to God, I don't know that here on this earth we could ever leave the culture that we came from our roots, or that we would want to. But then that also creates a diversity in the church of God. And that's a beautiful thing. But then we do need to realize to work with each other and understand each other, and not just to jump to judgments. So that's a quick overview on culture. Let's look at their culture a little bit. What do we think of when we think of any inner city culture? Is there anything that comes to your mind there? What are some aspects of the inner city or that comes to your mind when you think of their culture? And I'll just give you one. The first thing that comes to my mind is lots of free time. And that seems to be one of the larger detriments, especially in the children, is the amount of free time that they have just to do nothing. Any other things that comes to your mind? inner city culture. Crowded? Good? Good? What was that? Yep, yep, a large sense of family. That's right. That's right. Especially amongst the Puerto Ricans and the Spanish, they're very family oriented. I think of this thing of time, lots of free time. And we see it the minute you go into the street. You see older men who, during the middle of the day, who you know you think should be at work, just roaming the streets, sitting on their porches. You know, the porch seems to be a hub, especially in the summertime, where there's just lots of them just sitting there, not doing anything. There's ripe opportunities to minister. But, and the children, the streets being their playground, the alleys, the parks that you find in the corners or wherever you can find them, just time to do nothing. And because of this multitude of free time, they end up getting into all sorts of mischief. Gangs seem to be a huge attraction to them, whether they're big or small. And the mischief and the depth of sin that they find themselves in because of that free time is many years beyond their age. I'm always amazed at how much a 10-year-old child in the city knows about life. It is very sad. How many of you have ever heard the term Generation Y or Generation X? Raise your hand if you've heard that. Good, good. There are, I'm not even sure what those scientists are called. They're anthropologists or I'm not sure what they are. But they study people, they study generations, they study who you are, and they try to put different generations of people into a box and just kind of label them and say this is the computer age or this is the generation for this or for that. And they've come up with these terms they call Generation X, Generation Y, and now the latest one is Generation Z. And there's because it's not really official terms and official documents, I'm not sure. They don't really have an exact time frame when one starts and when the second one ends, like when Generation X ended and Generation Y began. And so some of that is kind of confusing. But the latest one they come out with is Generation Z. And the interesting thing about it, if you Google it on the internet, Generation Z, you will find a good bit of information will come up on it. But scientists are leaning away from that term because they're finding a huge shift in society in this last couple of years, last generation, they call it, and they've labeled it a different name that I find is very interesting. This is the first time that I can see where they've actually are using an alternative name besides X, Y, or Z. They call it Generation Me. Generation Me. And that is a very interesting thing. This is not a label that has been given to this generation from the Christian perspective. This is the world labeling the newest generation, Generation Me. And there are, yeah, this age group of this last generation, they refer to as Generation Me. There's not an exact age put on it again, but it would probably, everybody that you would find, that you would minister to in the city would fall under this category of Generation Me. Whether they would be from the age of 4, 5, or 6, all the way up to probably entry-level college. Somewhere around that range. There isn't an exact time frame there. So pretty much the focus of the people you would be ministering to would fall under this category. What are the characteristics of Generation Me? The importance of the individual, and these things that I'm telling you all came from the world's perspective, not from the Christian's perspective looking at it, but this is the world looking at themselves. The importance of the individual supersedes all other concerns. A generation mere says, I am number one. What happens to you, what happens to him, is a very little concern to me. What happens to me is of utmost concern. I am right here in the middle. And my world evolves around me. If it doesn't have anything to do with me, it's not part of my world. That's a Generation Me's philosophy. And we find that coming out more and more and more. You're important. You're special. You're number one. You deserve it. Look out for yourself. I mean, we see this in the advertisement age. advertisers who are focusing in on this group are using these very same slogans. You deserve it. What's that? I think, is that McDonald's? I can't remember right now. That's what they're focusing in on. These same slogans that these people are rising up in their selfishness, proclaiming about themselves, the advertisers are using to pinpoint them in that age group. You deserve it. Look out for yourself. You're number one. You've worked hard. You can use a break. I'm number one. Another way to point out the generation mirror, there is no single right way to live. There is no single right way to live. We have these clubs in the U.S. I'm not sure if you have them up here or not. They're called the Boys and Girls Clubs. And basically there's a couple of them in every city. I think Lancaster had three. I think they only have two now. And it's basically an off-the-street program. It's funded by donations and different organizations. And the children who are after school, they can go right to the club and they have activities for them there. They have off-the-street programs and things like that where they can just, parents use it as a babysitting thing for the most part. And for our route, I know a number of our routes pick up our students there and our children at the club where they'll go from school to the club, and then from the club we'll pick them up and go right to church on Tuesday night. And I know we pick up 2/3 of our route right from those clubs. And when we walked in, it was about 6 months ago, we walked into the club, and they had a big poster on the wall, right when you walk up. And this is the pledge. They call it the Boys and Girls Club Pledge. And all the children are taught this pledge, and they're teaching it to all the children in all the clubs across America. It goes like this. I believe in God and the right to worship according to my own faith and religion. I believe in America and the American way of life. In the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, I believe in fair play, honesty, and sportsmanship. I believe in my Boys and Girls Club, which stands for these things. Did you catch the first line? I believe in God and the right to worship according to my own faith and religion. What do they believe? They don't believe anything. They don't believe anything. And this is what they're being taught. They're being taught there is no right way to live. You can live however you want. It's all okay. If you want to be a homosexual, that's okay. If you want to live a single mom all your life, that's your choice. It's okay. You can live any way you want, and it's okay with God as well. That is extremely sad. These children are growing up with that perspective and that mentality. That's the kind of environment they're living in. It's a generation mirror. Does that give you a burden? Students are less likely to recognize the authority of teachers. I was sharing with, just before I got up here, we heard from I didn't hear him personally, but there was a public school teacher from Baltimore, Maryland, who had an urban youth workers retreat last weekend. I wasn't able to make it, but a couple of my friends did make it there, and they were telling me about it. And he came and he was sharing with the group there. And he is a public school teacher. He has been a public school teacher for 20 years. He is a solid Christian. And he said, this is what a typical public school classroom looks like. He said, if I can get 50% of my students' attention, I teach. That's the best you can get. He said, the other 50% are just doing whatever they want in the classroom. They're getting out of their seats. They're holding their own conversations. They're talking back and forth. They're disrespecting. He said, that's the best we can do. The public school doesn't have any other answers for them. That's all we have. Students are less likely to recognize the authority of teachers. And I thought, wow, we're doing better than that on Tuesday night. God must be doing a work in their lives. God's doing something. Former taboos regarding dating and marriage have evaporated. And I'm sure we see that as prevalent on the streets everywhere. Things that would never have been imagined 10, 15, 20 years ago are just a commonplace now. That's a generation mirror. Generation Me individuals are more willing to share their experiences, positive and negative, in explicit details with anyone who will listen. Morals are just going down the drain. And again, this is the world's perspective of our own generation, of this latest generation. Language that was considered profane has become commonplace. And that, you know, that's a fight we have every class night, every Tuesday night, you know, in the van. Someone gets upset. Someone says something. What do? Here comes this dual word before they can even think of what's going on and what they're saying. And then you have to deal with those things. They deserve everything right away. It was a couple weeks ago, I forget how many exactly, we had just finished up class, and we were bringing out snack. What we do is we pick them up, bring them to church, we have a time of singing, a class time, and afterwards we bring them snack. And the policy in our class is that they all have to be in their seats sitting down before we'll give them any snack. And this one particular boy, he just was going all over the place. I don't know what he was doing, he was just doing circles. And I said, James, you need to be in your seat. I want to bring you snack. You can't get any. Well, he's like, I don't got to listen to you. And he just does this, whatever. A couple minutes later, he starts yelling, where's my snack? Well, you need to be in your seat. And he slams himself down the closest seat he can find. And he says, okay, now I'm in my seat. Give me my snack. Well, I didn't give it to him right away. I said, with that attitude, you know, we're not going to give you your snack if you have an attitude like that. It's not appropriate attitude to have at church. So a couple minutes later, after he'd been sitting there for a while, I went and got a snack, and I was bringing it in. And as I was bringing it in, he yells out, bring me my snack right now. Okay, I turned around, went right back where I came from, put it back, and we went and talked with him again. And that's not the attitude you have. You have to be respectful. He was on the verge of not getting snack, but anyway, he did come up and we did bring him his snack. And a couple of minutes later, he had his juice in the ground, he bumped it and spilled it all over the floor. So one of the teachers says, James, you need to clean up your snack, your juice. I don't gotta clean it up, you clean it up. You spilled your juice, you need to go clean it up. And as he goes and gets the paper towels, he's wiping it up, he's muttering, phew, what am I, your servant? They deserve everything right away. They feel they can't do wrong, and they don't react well to criticism. And this last one, the entertainment age. And that's a big one. That one is a big one that we find. Hollywood has learned that these children have a hard time paying attention for any period of time. So much so that the advertisers have picked up on this, and when a commercial is shown in front of the children's face on television, it has to change scene, background, or something every 3 seconds in order to keep the interest of the viewer. Whether that's all true and where all those facts come from, I'm not sure, but at least the advertisement people said that is what they do for their advertisements in order to keep the interest of the individual. Constantly and trying to outdo the other person, or when they're watching on television, having the depth of whatever's happening in the scene get in more and more detail all the time to try to keep their attention, to the point of that such explicit content is being shown in front of these young children's eyes. iPods. I didn't have a cell phone until I was in my 20s. And now I have children coming to church, sitting in my class from the age of 8 to 11, and I have to deal with them having their cell phones out at 8 to 11 years old. Entertainment age. They have iPods. I think almost every single one in my class has iPods, and you have to make new rules all the time. You can't have your iPod in class. You can't be listening to music. They're just constantly being entertained. Entertain me is the cry of the generation mirror. Entertain me. And that makes a difficult audience. That makes a very difficult audience. But when they have so much of the world going after them with the advertisements, the entertainment, the electronics, all vying for their attention, and then we come in with the little hours we have and have something from the Word of God that can change their lives forever, we find a hard time getting their attention. It's not a surprise. They're getting labeled. If a child has a simple attention issue in school, he's quickly labeled ADD and put on drugs. That's just a simple answer. I don't know the percentages, but a high percentage of these children aren't even tested for it. It's just that's what they have. And it's no question that there's an issue based on what society is feeding them. Does that give you a burden for the city? That is a picture of their culture. Is that a culture of race? It's not a culture of race. It's not a culture of background or tradition. That's a culture of society. That's what our society has grown our children to be. That's what they live in. That's what they breathe in. That's everything about them. And it's just, even though we can point out all the other subcultures amidst the inner culture city of America, where we come from, or Canada, you have the Puerto Ricans, you have the African Americans, you have we have a lot of Haitians where we come from as well. There's also the Caucasians in there. And as the city population is growing, as Ruben said, more and more different cultures are mixing in there. But even though they all have their different backgrounds, they're all intertwined into this sinful culture of society from where they're growing up and where they're living. The broken homes, I think so many different issues and struggles that the children face can be brought back to that main issue of the broken home. Second Timothy chapter 3. This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. That pretty much sums it up. So now, when we hear that, and we have a burden on our heart for the city, for the inner city, for the culture that they're being raised up in, and we have a desire to minister them, is there a way that we can bring them from that culture into a biblical culture? We can give them a new perspective on life. You know, that perspective that their whole life is focused on. Is there a way that we can change them into a godly perspective? And it will stick. Can they survive in a culture like that? And those are all good questions. And I believe the answer is definitely yes. God has a way. And God has a plan. He has a burden for each one of them. And He wants to see each one of them come to salvation and a changed life. What God begins, He can finish. And we need to have faith in that. Culture is based on perspective. And may not have any grounding or any ties to race at all. Perspective. That's an interesting word, and that has a lot to do with culture as well. It's a person's perspective, his worldview. And many times, a person's or a group of people, a society, their perspective, many times, is based on a person's belief or opinion that may have been come from many, 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 many generations ago, and there may be no historical writing or no written documentation of that. It has just been something that has been passed down from generation to generation to generation until they have it now, yet they hold on to it and believe in it with everything they got. You ever play Whisper Down the Lane? Telephone, we call it, where a group of people sit in a row and one person whispers in someone's ear and they whisper to the next person's ear. Until it gets to the end, it's something all just skewed and messed up. There wasn't anything like it started. Well, imagine how something like that might be if it's passed down from generation to generation. How much different it might be now than how it was back then. Yet they hold to it with all they've got. Is culture wrong? No. Culture is not wrong. Is everything about culture right? No. Can there be right and wrong mixed in a culture? Yes, most definitely. And every culture has that. Here's an example. I'm not sure the dates, but back in decades ago, in the Chinese, back hundreds of years ago, actually, Back in the Chinese, it was a popular thing for the women to have their feet bound up into very small bindings, almost like a cast, and kept there for many, many years so that their feet would not grow big. It was believed in that culture that big feet were unattractive, and that in order to have any chance of marriage or be popularity or anything like that, you need to have small feet. So it was commonplace in that culture for the father, when his daughter is out of age, whatever age it is, I don't know, maybe as a young baby, to break their foot, tuck it up underneath, and bind it up in these bindings so that their foot would stay small. And that way all their life they would have these small feet. And I actually brought a picture, but it's too small, you wouldn't be able to see it. Imagine where did an idea like that come from? Small feet is attractive. If you want to be married, you have to have small feet. If you want to have any chance of any social status in life, you have to have small feet, and thus you have to have your feet broken and bound up and live in all that pain all your life. Yet it was commonplace. Every single girl had it done. Venture with me. What if one father would say, "This is ridiculous"? Of course, we all think that, but they didn't. "This is ridiculous. I am not going to break my daughter's feet. God gave her those feet. He gave her the feet that she would need to go through life. I'm not going to break them and bind them." And so he left them that way. Well, that little girl grew up, and now she's a teenager. All her peers have their feet broken and bound up, and they're enjoying their popularity status. And here she isn't. She's a misfit. She's left out. What do you think that girl would do in that situation, in that setting? What's that?
Turn bitter.
Turn bitter? Turn bitter at her father or people around her? Or she might run to her father and say, "Father, please break my feet and bind them up. I don't want to be an oddball. I don't want to be the only misfit. I want to be just like everybody else. I want to fit in. Please do it to me." She would beg for it. And that sounds ridiculous to us. But we have these things in our culture too. Think about abortion, for one thing. Abortion is a commonplace. There are, and my dad had printed out a sheet, and I tried to find it before I came, and I couldn't find it, where he had the abortion statistics for every year, starting when they first started taking statistics back in the mid-1900s, all the way up till presently, of how many abortions were done in the United States per year. And if you go back to the age that you were born, there were tens of thousands of children aborted in the year that each one of us was born. That's terrible. That is insane. But yet, that's socially acceptable in our country. Think about divorce and remarriage. That is two in every... I haven't checked to see if this was true, but I heard recently that it's two in every three marriages fail and end up in divorce in our country, in the United States. Two out of three. Well, that's not a very good track record. I remember I used to work at a sales lot where we sold lawn furniture and sheds. And many, many times we sold swing sets. And many times parents would come to our sales lot to purchase a swing set for their children. And when they would get in there to pick out the swing set and they get in there to pay, the father would take out his checkbook and he'd say, "Okay, I'll pay for..." What's the amount? Divided by two. "Okay, I'll pay for half." And the wife would take out her checkbook and she would pay for half out of her account. And the first time I saw that, I thought that was interesting that they would do that. They both had separate accounts. And then it happened again and again and again and again. It was a commonplace where their finances, they're living their lives, though they're married, separately. Their finances are all separate, just in case it might not work out. Well, a mentality like that, it won't work out. Two out of three marriages end in divorce. Gangs in the cities, you know, immorality. It's almost at the point now in the schools where if you reach a certain age and you haven't been immorally active, that you are a misfit. That's our society. So, what is biblical culture? What does God have for us? You know that there's good things and bad things in each culture that that make up of a culture. And when God brings a person to Christ, and in Christ, they come in Christ, those wrong things of the culture, they need to go. They need to be let go. But then, because we're coming from many different cultures, there is a diversity in the Church of Christ that is a beautiful thing. Colossians 1, 12 through 18. Giving thanks unto the Father, which hath made us meet to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in light, who hath delivered us from the power of darkness, and hath translated us into the kingdom of his dear Son, in whom we have redemption through his blood, even the forgiveness of sins, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature. For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence above all else. What is biblical culture? When God has the preeminence in our lives above all else. When he is that central focus of our lives. When he is that guiding factor that everything in our life consists under. And every decision that we make is from him and his word and what he guides in our lives. In verse 13, and who hath delivered us from the power of darkness, there was the old culture, and hath translated us into the kingdom of his dear Son. That is the new culture, God's kingdom for our lives. Now, how does that look for each of us? It may look different. Can we get to the place on this earth where we have only biblical culture? Where our whole culture is totally based on the Bible. Everything that we do is totally based in the Bible. I don't think so. I don't think we can do that on this earth. I think we'll only be able to see that in heaven. But at the same time, John, in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, when he was telling about his vision of when he went up to heaven, he said, I saw a multitude gathered around the throne of every tribe and every nation under earth. How did he know they were from every tribe and every nation? He must have seen a diversity. He must have seen a difference there. He must have seen different cultures sitting around the throne. And that is a beautiful thing. God has a heart for the different cultures. That's a beautiful thing. Romans 8:14. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. What is biblical culture? Those who are led by the Spirit of God. Have the Spirit of God moving throughout their lives. Galatians 5:16. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. There it is again, walking in the Spirit. The last one I have, Galatians 5:25. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. That is God's heart for all the people of the world. For the people who are living in the inner city, for the people wherever we might find them on the streets, to leave their culture, wherever it might be. No, I shouldn't say leave their culture. Because I don't believe that's God's heart at all. I believe God loves culture. And I believe God loves all the culture. But he wants us all to be united under the culture of his kingdom, which is being a people that are living and leading in the Spirit of God, having the Spirit of God living and leading their lives. And that is a beautiful thing. I had to think, God must, seeing that picture of God sitting on his throne and all the cultures of the world gathered around him, and his heart for the people of the world coming out and right there in that place, he has a heart for all the people of the world, for all the different cultures, whether we came from the East Coast, whether we came from the West Coast, whether we came from the inner city, or whether we came from a plain background, whatever we might find ourselves, God has a heart. Yes, we must leave those things of the culture that are wrong and of sin. But yet there's a diversity in where we come from. I had to think, is there any other place in all the world where so many different cultures can come together and have sweet fellowship together and unity other than the Church of Christ? I don't think so. At least I don't know of any. And that's a beautiful thing. That's a beautiful picture when you can see so many different cultures come together in a beautiful way and all have the same thing in common, and that is the Spirit of God flowing through their lives. So that's our heart. That's my heart. I know God has a heart for the city. And even though we have, it seems a little overwhelming to look at what their culture has created for them, what their society is, yet God has a desire to see them come to Christ. And He has equipped each of us with whatever we may need to do His work and His ministry in there. And I know that whatever He starts in a person's life, He'll finish. And if He brings them to Christ, you might think, well, how can they live in a society like that, even after they become a Christian? God is faithful. Whatever He started, I know that He has a desire to finish in their lives. And He has a desire to see them come to Christ. So that's all that I have here. I guess we'll open it up shortly here. If anybody has any questions, I think they have some microphones they're going to pass around. If anybody has any questions they'd like to ask, then we'd be happy, me or Ruben, to answer them. Does anybody have any questions? There's one up here. There's one right here.
Given the entertainment idea in the kids, do you use entertainment in the class to get the attention?
It's a very good question. It's a good question. I do plan on discussing that some tomorrow, but just to answer it here, I think even though they're a product of society and they have this attention span is very short, God has given us clear instructions in the Scripture of how we are to reach out to them. And we are in this world, but not of this world. And so I believe that there is a place where we are to be creative in the way that we reach out to them, in the way we teach them, but not using the methods of the world in a compromising way. And I guess I can just give a real quick example of that would be the movie that came out, The Passion of the Christ. And it's an interesting idea where the creators of that realized that in order to reach the gospel to this generation, it was going to have to be something that was beyond the limits of what they've seen already. In order to get the gospel to them. And so they created Christ's death in an R-rated movie. That's sad. It's sad. And that's an extreme case of somebody using, you know, the world's methods of entertainment to try to reach them. But in general, I would say, you know, we do at times show a documentary or something on creation versus evolution, a DVD to them. We do have actually in my route, we have a projector that we use at times where we might make a PowerPoint of our lesson and put that up on the screen and things like that, that we do at times, though we don't make a habit of that.
Ruben mentioned that some families have moved into the city. Can you just expand on that and tell us what that looks like? What your vision is, how do you make that work in real life, in real time?
I'm going to pass that over to Ruben. Let him answer that one.
Yeah, well, there's several ways to look at that. I tend to look at it a little bit more of a practical level of it's a place to live. And it's actually a very economical place to live. I can buy a place there cheaper than I can rent one in the country or in the city. So that's one way of looking at it. There's four of us families that live there, and we're scattered. There's two of us that live side by side, but we are scattered, and that's our desire to be scattered rather than all on one pile so that we can be a light in the community, especially in the immediate community, not just to those that we're ministering to on a regular basis, but the immediate community that we can minister where we're at to our neighbors. For myself, my desire or my goal in moving in was to pave the way for others to be able to move in. And I was in administration, and so had a lot of responsibilities toward the staff and the ministry and even some logistics, which the logistics has been taken off of me now. But so that was my goal, was to be able to be there, be available for the staff, and to be able to facilitate the ministry for them. And we're blessed now to have three other families besides ourselves, but their primary goal is to be a missionary. And I believe that it takes some accountability one to another. I mean, there are a lot of influences and things. I believe the purpose should be clear, why we're there, and what, you know, keep each other accountable and all of that. But it's been a blessing to us. The question is, am I full-time, or some full-time, or are we tent makers? We actually all have jobs. I work only 3 days a week, try to keep up with everything else, but I think everyone else has a full-time job. I'm wrong about that. Samuel is another one that is working part-time to be able to have time for ministry. He drives school bus in the city and has a lot of opportunity working with the high school children, busing them back and forth. And that's a tremendous opportunity. There's another one of the young men that is just getting into that as well as busing. Mm-hmm. And he hopes to move into the city before too long. For myself, I work from home, so I have the blessing of being available, being flexible. Even in the days that I do work, I have flexibility.
Good. Thank you, Ruben. Is there any other questions? Okay, then. Thank you all for coming out and giving us this opportunity. We really appreciate it. And our desire is to inspire. And I hope we can do just that. So thank you for listening, and I think we're dismissed. Thank you.